Okay. So this is Wednesday, July 21st, 2001, and it's the UCF BOT bargaining team with the UCF UFF chapter of bargaining team, and we're here to collectively bargain. So, Brianna, I don't remember getting a copy of the minutes, but that doesn't mean I didn't. It just means I probably overlooked it, but okay, there it is.
Yeah.
Anybody have any issues with the minutes from last time?
I think it looks good to me.
Yeah, I don't see anything to lot.
Yeah, I'm fine. Thanks.
Okay, then the minutes are fine, so we can move on to the agenda that Talat thoughtfully provided for us.
Right, so we have, we go over some of the items there. I think not everything we are ready for, but the first one was we have that UF will respond to BOT proposal on Article 20. So if that's okay, we'll begin with that.
Absolutely.
All right. So let's see.
Claudia is having some difficulties getting into the room, and I think she should be present when we talk about Article 20.
She's not here?
No, she isn't. She just sent me a message.
Oh, she sent you a message. She's coming?
Yes, she's coming, but she's having some Zoom issues.
Okay, so why don't we do Article 13? And then, because that is the simple one, so we do, nothing is simple until you are then done with it, but all right, okay. So why don't we do this? We'll switch, we'll do Article 13 first, and we'll wait till Claudia is here. And let's see, so I will go over and we'll do start sharing, and I think we want to do that one, so we'll do share. Okay, so let me know if you can see and if I should make it bigger or whether it's okay.
Looks good from where I am.
Okay, so this is essentially this is on layoffs and recall, and we have a few changes here, most of it, just sometimes even grammatical. So the one here, I don't have the line numbers, but maybe we can skip that, okay. So the layoff unit shall be at an organizational level of the university, such as a campus, division, college, unit, school, so on. And then we also added to that program or other level of organization as the university and the UFF, UCF deem appropriate. So that's what, that's the change there. And the reason for including is that, if we are adding new programs or new organizations, a discussion between the two sites seems appropriate.
Talat, I'm looking at a version online of the current CBA,
mm-hmm.
and that change for program is already in the...
it's already there?
So where did this language come from?
This came from the one that... So, John, do you have an idea?
Yeah, no, this came from the, I took it from the current version of the CBA.
Oh, well, I'm looking at the printed version and it's in there, so.
Program is in there, but what's not in there is NUFF UCF.
Yes, yeah. Okay.
Where we realize that.
The program was already,
Yeah, program was already there, Tala, I think.
Right. So program is there. Mm-hmm. What we have done is just reverse the order, you see?
Yeah.
Oh, no. What would
I think...
No. Okay. So this was already there. So that's all the better. Then we basically have to say...
I think it was much more of a grammatical... I think we were trying to go for our grammatical change.
Yeah, but let me just see let me see if I do this right now. That means, oh, okay. So I just should do delete, and then I should accept deletion. Yeah. So,
okay.
So what you're saying is that this is the language right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm seeing that in there already.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And the shell, is that already there?
No, that is a change.
No, that's May. The current language says May.
Okay, May. Okay.
And it's helpful if you're presenting these tracked versions to include the language that's being struck.
Right. That's what I did here. So, I see. I see what you're saying. Yeah. In other words, then we should show the May that we've canceled.
That would be preferable.
Yes. I also agree with that. I would prefer that too. So we'll do that. So somehow we'll have to.
We can fix that. Okay.
And then I could do strike through that or something. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you guys know how to strike through. I don't.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So I'll not do that, but maybe if you can do that. I agree with you, and I will try to follow the same with my colleagues here.
Thank you.
That's good. Okay. So that's there. And then there's one other item which was more of a clarification here. So where employees are equally qualified under A or B above, those employees will be retained who, in written justification by the university. We just, because the way it was, it just wasn't clear, if it is a judgment, what is the judgment? How do we know what the judgment is? And if it's a written justification, clarifies why we are talking about employees who are equally qualified. So that would be the rationale for that change. Notice. Employees should be informed of layoff as soon as practicable. We are crossing off and where circumstances permit, because first of all, we've already said as soon as practicable, and employees need to be informed. So we don't see the need for, why add the clause and where circumstances permit? So that's the change there. I think that's all.
Okay.
I'll stop sharing and.
Yeah, I think there's maybe one in there. Maybe one or two that we want to take it. We'll have to have some conversation about, but we're getting close.
Sure. I mean, again, we are suggesting a language and you take and see.
Right.
Goes. Yeah. Great. So I think we should have you guys present, and I see Claudia is already here. So after that, we could do Article 20, but why don't we alternate?
All right. You want us to go next?
Yes.
So
I think I've got Article 12.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm going to try to share a screen. Is that working?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is for me.
Yep.
Okay. We took a look at Article 12, starting from the status quo language, and had in mind the suggestions that you had made the last time we got together about this particular article. As we looked at it, there's some of the changes that have been suggested where we're going to prefer the status quo language, and we'll try to talk a little bit about why that's the case. For example, I want to address first language in lines 20 through 24 on the screen. Last time, the UFF proposed that we separate auxiliary and CNG employees. We would prefer to keep the status quo language. The auxiliary folks previously had no notice. They were brought in and made like the CNG people last time, and we think that's really appropriate. And Sherry actually mentioned this at our last session, that the CNG units or CNG employees and the auxiliary employees are very much alike in that they are dependent upon having a source of funding readily available to allow them to continue. So we think that those two particular classes of employees are very, very similar, and it makes sense to continue to address both of those classes in with the same language. Now, there's another change that we're proposing that shows up on beginning on line 22. There was a difference in the amount of notice that was given to employees with 3 or more years versus 5 or more years of service in the existing contract. What we're finding out is with some, particularly when we're talking about CNG or auxiliary employees who may have 5 or more years experience, 90 days notice requires that they receive a lot of notices of non-reappointment, because, for example, if they're CNG employees and a contract is running out, even though an extension has been requested or new proposals have been submitted, because of that need to do the 90 days notice, there are a bunch of people that regularly get notices that they're being non-reappointed, and then the funding comes in and they're reinstated, and they go on until the next year when the same thing comes up. So what we've proposed is for the folks with 5 or more years service that we go to the 60 days of notice here in line 22.
And then, clarify this a little bit for me, Chuck, because I mean, I deal more with CNG employees than auxiliary employees. And for CNG, it is totally dependent on grants, federal grants, external money, right?
Correct.
And for them, basically, you know, when you have the period, so for example, if I have people on DOE grant, this DOE grant typically gets renewed every 3 years. And so we always have the deadline, you know, that this is when the grant is going to end, but we also have a proposal in, and DOE is pretty good about renewing, NSF is not, right? So I cannot be giving my CNG employees I have one person like that, a non-reappointment all the time, because we know that, you know, we'll be renewed. On the other hand, God forbid something happens and we are not renewed, then there will be no money to pay the individual. Right. And that's the understanding with which we are working, that the CNG appointment is contingent on funding. This is a little different from what I understand now about auxiliary appointments, because these are the programs that UCF has. You know, it's different from me as a faculty member having a program and UCF having a program in which it is employing people. It is still based on availability of funds, but it is a planned activity of the university as opposed to planned activity of a faculty member. So that was the rationale why we thought that the two categories were really different. Now for CNG, I don't know what the 60-day would mean. You know, if the grant didn't get renewed, there is no money and there's nobody there to pay it.
Well, I hear you. Sometimes, and it says that in here, provided that, you know, funds are available, this can be done. If there is no money in a CNG account, there may not be any way to pay somebody through that notice period. That's entirely
possible.
That was
the reason why we wanted to separate them out, so that there's no confusion.
But I think very similar things can happen with auxiliary units as well. And one that comes to my mind right now is parking services. During the pandemic, all of a sudden, nobody's coming to campus and paying $5 a day to park. And there were many employees that didn't renew their permits. Also, that's a unit that's dependent upon funds coming in. Now, I don't know what happened. That's an example of an auxiliary unit where all of a sudden things changed dramatically. That could happen with another auxiliary unit as well. And the goal here is we would like to be able to pay people through the notice period, but we need to make sure that we're not continually giving people notice and then having to reinstate them. That's something that we want to avoid. And we need to recognize that even though there are some differences between CNG and auxiliary employees, in a lot of ways they're very similar because they need to have those funds readily available for them to be continue to be paid.
Okay.
So I understand the differences. You know, one is very much dependent upon what the faculty member does, and the auxiliary not so much. It depends more on what's happening around the institution. But the same situation comes up because we've got to have money to pay those people. We can't use, for example, E&G funds to pay the auxiliary or CNG employees.
Mm-hmm. Student housing had a similar situation when the pandemic hit. And, you know, we actually had to refund money to students, mm-hmm. which was a huge cost mm-hmm. to the university. So it's not common.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness we don't have
pandemic. Yeah, eventually, this is pandemic, right.
But it does happen. And mm-hmm. We do have one or two auxiliary units that, as I think before, have dedicated sources of funding. The CDL folks are one because they have the tech fee, which supports them, which given what's going on in higher education in general, seems to only be going to be increasing, not decreasing the amount of online education everyone's using. But that's not necessarily the same thing as parking or housing or creative school,
mm-hmm.
for example. As some of these units, creative school comes to mind particularly, operate on very thin margins. And if you have to give somebody there,
mm-hmm.
90 days. I mean, that's almost impossible for them to do. And it's, so that's why we made those changes. But, you know, it's something mm-hmm. for you guys to consider and
right.
talk about and come back and, you know,
yeah.
counter.
A quick question, Chuck. Does the university have no funds other than E&G funds? It could be used to pay parking employees?
The way the auxiliary units work, the parking employees are paid with funds that parking collects.
I understand that that's normally the case, but in extreme unusual circumstances, does the university have non-E&G funds that they could use to pay salaries for parking employees?
I don't know for sure the answer to that question. I don't know what all the rules are about that funding, but I don't believe that E&G funding can be used for that. Sherry may know more about that than I do.
The only funds that we would have that I would be aware of would be like foundation funds, and there are a lot of limitations on what those can be used for. So I don't think that would be, I mean, generally you don't use your foundation money for salaries because a lot of it is restricted, but I don't know of any other sources other than E&G, CNG, and whatever we get out of the foundation.
But even E&G, is there a restriction on E&G? For example, you know, there are one-time funds that are available. And we're talking about a pandemic, you know, I mean, I don't think this would happen all the time. But since you raised the issue of parking, if there were one-time funds available, they couldn't be used? E&G funds could not be used?
The argument you're making is that there is this potentially extreme, unusual circumstance. And I understand that. But in the extreme, unusual circumstance, are there no other funds? And that's the question that I'm posing, and I hope that you guys can come back to us with to support your argument that you are necessarily forced to provide this shorter notice period.
Well, wait a minute. You're saying, when you said you were forced to provide that sort of notice period, if it's in the contract, then we have to give them 60 days or 90 days, whatever's in the contract. And we don't have a pot of like emergency funds over here that we can use to for these types of things. So the answer basically is no. If the issue is you want to just split CNG and auxiliary, but give the same, this is the first time that auxiliary's even had any rights in the contract. I'm not, from an organizational standpoint, if that's what you're don't like, is that you want them separated out for organizational purposes. That's one thing, but if you're saying you want different notice rights available to auxiliary, that's not where our position is.
Well, I mean, I'm understanding that the red strikeout on lines 23 and 24 was in a previous contract?
Yes.
So that was something the university had previously agreed to. Mm-hmm. And all these rules on funding, et cetera, haven't really changed, have they?
No, the concern about the 90 days that I was trying to mention, Kevin, was that there are some people who, because of that 90-day notice requirement, frequently are notified that they're about to be non-reappointed. And that doesn't happen so much with people on auxiliary lines, but it happens with the CNG people because the uncertainty of research funding.
And I'm trying to discuss the auxiliary employees who are not employees of faculty members, but employees of the university in a very real sense, and the university's obligation to these employees.
Yeah, and that's...
So your argument about what happens with CNG, it's entirely valid for CNG.
Right.
But as we've just discussed, it's not relevant to auxiliary.
I mean,
well, it is relevant to auxiliary, because they aren't being paid. They are very similar, and with a few exceptions, to CNG in the fact that they have to earn their keep, so to speak. And we did, in the last round of bargaining, add notice period for auxiliary appointments. That's the first time auxiliaries have ever had notice rights. We added it, but we're finding that it has been very, under certain circumstances, it's very, very difficult for us to implement. And you know, we would like to make a change in that. That's all I can say.
Okay. So basically what you're saying is that for the auxiliary to whom it applies mainly, you want to cut it to 60 degrees rather than the 90 degrees mm-hmm. that you're asking.
Yeah.
But there isn't, do you have some data that shows that this has been a real problem? That's one thing. Whenever we go back on something, you know, from 90 days to 60 days, there has to be some rationale for it, right? So that rationale is not obvious to us. I think that's one of the points. The other is, you know, because the pandemic came up, that's why these issues are coming up for the auxiliary appointments, that they seem to be part of functioning of the university. So if there's a pandemic, are there ways in which people who are in those appointments be supported since they are university employees? I think that's probably what.
All right, we take your point.
Yeah, okay. All right, let's move on.
Okay, the next section I want to draw your attention to is lines 25 through 38, talking about the ENG appointments.
Mm-hmm.
The version that you had shared with us of this particular article separated the tenured and tenure-earning faculty separated tenured and tenured-earning employees. And the tenured employees are not subject to this article. And that's why they've never been mentioned in here. The tenured employees cannot be non-reappointed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's just not been covered in here. There's some language that you propose to add that would provide additional protections for tenure earning faculty, that they would have to have two consecutive shutouts essentially on the CPEs. And you know, we would prefer not to include that. We prefer the status quo language to cover these tenure earning employees. There are not many tenure earning employees that become subject to the non-reappointment, and we don't see that there's an issue here that the tenure earning employees are at any particular risk. So if there are cases that you are familiar with that you want to bring our attention to, you know, please feel free to share those. But we're not aware of a big issue with the tenure earning faculty. So we would prefer to continue with the status quo language and not address the tenured faculty that are completely protected from non-reappointment. Below that, what begins here in line 31 and goes through line 38 is something that we've referred to as a bright line. And last time you had suggested to us a different bright line of May 7th, which was something that had been in an earlier contract. We had agreed last time that it was going to be September 30th. I think this is the third different bright line that we had. As I recall, it went from May 7th, I think, to August 14th or something like that, and then to September 30th. And we think the September 30th is working pretty well in most cases. However, there are decisions that units make at various times in the year. And what we are proposing here is multiple bright lines that would allow employees who receive notice of non-reappointment to finish the term that they're in. The notice would come early in the term by September 30th, January 30th, or May 31st. They would finish the term they're in and get one more term. So for example, as it stands right now, people get notice by September 30th, finish the fall semester, and they get the spring semester. People who would receive notice by January 30th would complete the spring and then potentially could have some summer employment as well. People who are noticed by May 31st would potentially have some employment in the summer and then would have employment in the fall, but then not the following spring. And we think the additional flexibility associated with the multiple bright lines would be very helpful for everybody and very clear about.
But what you had before, I mean, this is going back a few years, was 1 year, because they got they would be given non-reappointment on May 7th, and they had a full year.
That's what it said. Yes.
Yeah. That's what we had before.
Yes.
And even the September 30th, that, you know, we didn't like that it was shifted from May to September, But even the September 30th was giving them a whole year. What it was at least giving them.
You're right. It gave them
so basically
two terms.
But what you're doing right now is reducing it to one term.
No, what I'm saying is you get the rest of the current term, which has barely begun, plus the next one.
Chuck, I mean, your item B does not promise the next one at all.
No.
May be available.
Well, summer funding is always uncertain.
Yeah, but so the person is, so go ahead.
The commitment for a January 30th is equivalent to the commitment of a September 30th, A, only, you'll just give it to them in January instead of September.
Mm-hmm. It's basically giving UCF the advantage of not informing the student, the faculty member for a whole semester.
It just doesn't, a full year, of course, includes the summer. Dropping it to two semesters is undesirable. And dropping it to one semester some of the time, as an item B, is very undesirable. I think
at present, it is already at two semesters. That's where we are today with the September 30th date.
But you know, the academic cycle.
Start notice in January, they would get the rest of the spring. And then depending upon their circumstances, they may be in a unit that would need their teaching services in the summer. I don't know. They may be people who have access to research funding as well that could provide a contract in the summer.
You know, for a university that depends so heavily on the services of people who provide so much teaching, I think this is just moving backward. Because we're going from giving them 1 year to giving them two semesters to now saying, well, you can be told January 30th that you have no job, and because we can't guarantee you any summer, so you're basically out on May 7th. So this is really not even a semester if you're telling them on January 30th. It's basically four months. And this is really going backward in time, and I don't see how we can be, you know, endearing lecturers and instructors and others and then saying, well, you know, you're just like adjunct. So I think this is something, but we'll move on, but this is not.
Okay.
Something.
All right. Well, this is what we're recommending.
Yeah.
What to do.
Yeah.
I want to go to the last two lines, 66 and 67, that addresses the situation where there might be someone who's been given the two-term notice. If they're a nine-month employee and have not been offered summer employment at the time of non-reappointment, no summer compensation will be offered, just to make that clear. But if they've been offered summer employment already, or if they have access to summer employment, they would be entitled to it. The last thing that I wanted to talk about is the payout option. I know last time the UFF expressed some interest in having the employee be able to opt in, and that may be something that we could consider. But to have any chance at all to pay out, whether it be the university's preference or the preference of the employee, the payout option language must be in the CBA. We can't pay somebody out, even if the employee wants it, if it's not in the CBA.
Sure. So we can add that.
There has to be some treatment of the payout option in Article 13.
Right. But that's fine. We can add that in. The only thing is that it should not be one way. Because the way it is like right now, it is only the university that elects and not the faculty member. The faculty member has to agree to that. That's what. That's all.
This is our preference.
And, yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you've got alternative language that covers the payout option, we would be.
That's it. Yeah. No. We can certainly do that. Yeah. Certainly do that.
So that's our Article 12.
Okay.
And does my team have anything to add to Article 12?
No. You did it. I don't.
All right, so let's see. So we can, so at some point, you know, we will, when look at some of the changes that you've offered, I think we will have to have some discussion about the philosophy behind it, because my impression, and I've had some conversations directly as well, that the present administration wants the place to be faculty and student friendly, and to go on to an environment where we are, you know, looking at positive energy, looking at things so that, you know, things are working well for both administration and faculty and students. But if we are trying to, you know, take away privileges, then that is giving a different message. So at some point we'll have to have that discussion, because we were and are hopeful that with the Alex Cartwright, there would be a more congenial, collegial environment. And for that to happen, I think, we shouldn't be taking away privileges, even if they're small, because, you know, the privileges we're talking about affects instructors and lecturers and untenured faculty. I don't see any reason why we are going backward, unless we have got in place an administration that actually is not wanting to be faculty friendly. And I think we'll have to think about that. And if that is what Alex Cartwright and his team want, then we'll have to work accordingly. And if they want the more friendly environment, which is what I got from talking to him directly, then we have to, this has to show up in the CBA. But we'll talk about that when we go over the various items. So, I think now it's our turn. So maybe we can go over, and I think Claudia is here, and I think, oh no, this is probably not, let me see if that's, let me just make sure that I've opened the right, okay. I guess I was not sharing the screen. Let me see what happens.
No, you were sharing the screen talk.
I was sharing the screen, it just went, okay. All right, so I will do that. No, this is 13. I don't want to do that. Sorry about that. I thought I had it all ready to go. Yeah. Okay, I think I got it now. And let me go back and do. Right, so. Okay, can you see it now?
Yes.
All right, so let's see. I guess we have Charlie's comments, which are, I think comments are somehow appearing a little bit further down. So I think though that change came from Charlie, I think.
Yeah. Oh, if you go back up to review and all markup.
I think I had all markup. It should have. Yeah, it has all markup. And it says show comment. It has everything. So let's move on to where we have, I see. So yeah, so this is just, I think this was a change that was suggested. Yeah, yeah, that's, I guess you have to just clip. I don't know how, you know, when we transfer from one.
Oh, Talat, do you want me to share it on from my side?
You have it, is it better?
Yes.
Okay, all right. I can stop share, you can do it.
Yeah, give me just a moment.
Thank you. The comments are there on mine, so I can click on them and be, okay, all right.
So should be seeing the screen.
Yeah, we do. Let's see, make sure that the comments are shown on the side. Okay, all right,
So there was a change, I think, back up in line 5, that I believe what came from your proposal. We do accept.
Okay.
We do accept the deletion. And basically we took your proposal and made comments on the side. Your latest proposal accepted or at the dean's level. We agree to that change. Philot, do you want me to keep going or?
Yeah, keep going. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's fine.
So we kind of talked about language about, okay, what does like business hours or something. So we had a conversation last time and I think, we were kind of going back and forth between Eastern Standard and Eastern Daylight. And then, so we agree on the concept. We just added a comment of just saying Eastern. So I think it covers both Eastern Daylight and also Eastern Standard Time. I think that's a compromise rather than saying local time. Except the changes from regarding just the title of Article 16. The next one was just accepting the minor languages of appropriate form in the appendices, or timestamp referring to the email of when the email was received. Going down here, so this is the this is where our first disagreement is. Your side proposed to do more of a summary at the step one rather than a written decision, and our preference is status quo language, and then the same with the proposed change on 164 or decision versus document. We prefer the status quo language to correspond with the decision language. We accept the change going down to lines 179 and 180 when we were talking about processing of email and timestamps. We accept the language.
Just a quick question, John.
Yeah, Chuck.
In my notes from last time, that is the place where we talked about Orlando time or local time. Do we want to say 5 p.m. Eastern time there?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good catch. I'll go ahead and update this document, and then the updated document we'll send out to you. So by 5 p.m. Eastern.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good catch. So this is where we had some additional suggestions after conferring with other institutions around the state and with our parent organization, talking about the arbitration process. I think these changes will be beneficial for both sides. We'll start with just striking the language upon request of the grievant. So it would just read the UFF may proceed to arbitration. And then accepting your change about the submitting into the appendix the appropriate form. I know last time we made some updates to this section on line 207 to 208 when we talked about who actually has to sign the form. We added in the language or designee. So this is just going through and just removing the titles of positions within our organization and making everything local, still keeping in the designee language. And then also on lines 210 to 11, mirroring the same strike through from the 208 209, and then also from the request of the grievant. And then this kind of this going down into the stipulation about I have a mental hang up on this word, the arbitrability of an issue. We're going to propose eliminating the section that deals with that, and this language would take its place. So we would propose that both parties would recommend issues to the arbiter, and then who will actually decide based off of the submitted evidence. So we think this is a much more streamlined process than following the process under the 20.8 F4, which I'll get to I'll get to further later. So I know in the past we've had some issues with the panel in the previous round of negotiations. The Board of Trustees, your side suggested eliminating the panel. So I think in at least one or two of the proposals. So instead of doing the panel, we're proposing this language is once a grievance is escalated to arbitration, the parties may pick an arbitrator if both sides mutually agree. If not, a panel would be provided by the American Arbitration Association. So that takes out of the equation of, okay, do we not have a full panel? Is this person not able to serve? And it saves time and efficiency at the beginning of selecting who's a panel and then keeping up with it. So this is this is our proposal for a selection of an arbiter. So with this language, if the selection process is accepted, this language does not need to, on lines 226 to 229, doesn't need to be in the contract anymore because it deals with if we can't agree with someone on the panel. So the Board of Trustees talked about our proposed language about the non-tenure earning capacity, and we went back and forth on that. I think just to make everything very simpler, just simple is just to strike the language and just leave it at a arbiter's decision awarding employment beyond the 6 years shall not entitle an employee to tenure. Just leave it at that sentence. We believe that that's very clear going forward. And then this is the proposed language that was struck in terms of the arbitrability. This section is no longer needed if the above section language is accepted. So we feel that this brings a very streamlined, a very efficient process to arbitration, kind of updating a lot of the traditional blue book language that we've had over the years. Let me just kind of finish this and then we'll go back to questions. So if we accept the language in 20.9, and then I know we had a very spirited conversation about what does timeliness mean in our last conversation about this article. We feel that this language that we proposed really solidifies our point, and we prefer our proposed language in the proposal. So with that, is there any questions?
John, when you're talking about choosing from having the American Arbitration Association choose the arbitrator, I have to think about that. Yeah, our problem with the whole panel idea was not that we wanted to necessarily get away with, do away with a panel, but it just, we, I think in the 16 years that I've been bargaining, maybe the very first contract, the two sides actually met within 90 days to put together a panel. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, we just not ever seem to be able to do that. So that has become a problem. And mm-hmm. I don't have, my only question about, and I have to think about this, but about...
Sherry, let me say something real quick. So the American Arbitration Association would provide a panel.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to
My only question about that, and I hesitate to bring this up because I'm not in favor of their panels either, but when we do impasse, we usually get PERC to provide the panel. I'm not crazy about PERC as a choice, but the only thing that I don't know about the AAA, and I just have to do some research on it, is I think one of the problems that we have in arbitrations a lot, and also in impasse, though, to be fair, is we get people who, at least currently, most of the people on our panel are people who do arbitrations regularly in Florida now, and they're familiar to some extent with the contract. They work with the SUS enough, most of them, that they have some of understanding of our, you know, most of our contracts aren't that mm-hmm. different. I mean, yes, they are in certain articles, but, you know, overall, we're all still pretty close to the blue book. I'm concerned if we get the AAA, I want to make sure that we have the ability to get arbitrators who also are not hideously expensive because they're coming from Illinois or someplace. I'm not saying I am opposed to this. I just am a little concerned about that aspect of it. But I think it's an interesting option and certainly worth considering, but I just put that out there because it's something that when I looked at that, I thought,
So are you saying, Sherry, that we shouldn't restrict it to this organization only, or?
I don't know. I think you're right. I think it's good that we have an ability to get some outside entity to do this if we can't agree. But I don't know if AAA is the one
Is the one, yeah, okay.
I just want to think about it, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if there are other ideas, then we could also look into that.
Yeah. In terms of the who can sign the arbitration thing, I don't really, as far as I'm concerned, I don't have a dog in that hunt. I don't care. We only had the stuff about the state because that's what we were told, that you guys weren't allowed to make the decision locally. So, and at one time I think that was true, but maybe things are changing at the state level. They're recognizing it's just impracticable that you know, somebody at the local level should be able to sign these because that has caused issues in the past. So if your state people are okay with it, that doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, these recommendations came from them. So.
Yeah, I'm sure they got tired of getting harassed by us.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Okay.
We're moving on down. Let me see.
Did you want me to go down to the next section?
Yeah, let's see. Okay. I think our only concern, and I'm just speaking of the things that jumped out at me as we went through this, our only concern about the issues of, go on down further. I'm sorry.
Sure.
So you're not okay, but you see what we did with two.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So,
Sherry, this is Claudia. The elimination of the bifurcated arbitrability Is that something that you think your side will agree to? Or should we talk about it?
Where are we going?
I think that was a little bit up.
That was at line 257.
Right there.
And related to that, I believe, my computer is being crazy, so I may not be on screen, but I think related to that, we had proposed language earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just want to flag it that I would like to just know if you have any questions about it.
I think they need to take a look at the whole thing.
Yeah, because this ties into a previous.
Right.
So I need to look at them. And
yeah, you can. It goes back to 213. I mean, the proposed change there is to that we are taking out the two-step, which is always longer, right? The bifurcated arbitrability and arbitrationary. But, you know, we'll try to agree on an issue of arbitration. And if there is any dispute, then that will be decided by the arbitrator. Based on evidence, but we're not going to have two different arbitration
hearings. So you're saying that then the arbitrator decides the issue and then you go straight to a hearing right then?
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, and I think this has been true in the last couple of times that we've had to deal with it, either we already agree on what the issue is, right? It's a clear statement of arbitration, or if there is a disagreement, most of the times this has been figured out with both parties back and forth without the arbitrability hearing, even if we had one scheduled. So I think what is in here is simply saying we stipulate the issue. If there is no stipulation reached, then we tell the arbitrator what each side thinks. The arbitrator decides what the issue is, and then the hearing commences.
I don't know about that, Claudia. I'll have to think about that seriously, because depending on how far apart the parties are, if an arbitrator decides one way or the other, I mean, either way, one side or the other, may change who they have determined they're going to call as witnesses, what documents they're going to present, et cetera. So that might be problematic, and it might be problematic for either side. So
yeah, I mean, I just wanted to flag it as something just a change to how we're doing things. I think it would hopefully be a way of speeding up the process and you know, requiring less scheduling of people who are hard to schedule, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So I just wanted to flag it as something that we need to think about.
Yes.
John, while you're at line 210, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is that timestamp okay?
Yeah, I think that just refers to some things could be by email. Therefore, it's the timestamp from email.
Yeah, timestamp refers to email.
Yeah, I know. I just want to make sure it was okay.
Yes, it's accepted. Yeah.
We could, another way of doing that is we could add a definition in the definition section of what timestamp or email or, we could, this is just off the cuff here, but we could address it when it comes to definitions in terms of what does email mean and what does time and so on and so forth and timestamps.
We'll have to define timestamp.
Yeah.
Or what receipt means, date of receipt or time of receipt means, depending on different media, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's a conversation we can have once we reach the definition section.
My question was really much simpler. It seemed like you had accepted that.
Yes, we did.
Here in other places.
We did. We
yeah, did yes. Thing. Sorry, yes. Okay. Our proposal recognizes say or timestamp that we accept all changes on that.
All right, super.
Anything we didn't accept, we did mark.
Okay.
And did you have any other questions, Sherry, with this language?
No, but I thank you, Claudia, for bringing that to my attention. I'm sure I would have figured it out when I looked at it again, especially with the sharp eyes of my team, that I was not helpful.
Well, and also, as we're on this screen, striking all of those sentences, it's just important to note, I think, here, this section is about defining the role of the arbitrator.
Right.
Right. And so it's basically limiting what an arbitrator can do or what one can be expecting from an arbitration. And so I think it is important, the first sentence is important in terms of a limitation. The arbitrator's decision, the arbitrator doesn't get to award tenure. They get to potentially, if there is a case, award employment beyond the 6 year, but that doesn't mean that therefore automatically tenure is granted. That, I think, is an important limitation of the rights of the arbitrator that is spelled out here. The rest of that is all very much administrative stuff internal to employment agreements and stuff, and doesn't really add anything and doesn't have to do with anything to do with the rights of the arbitrator or the role of the arbitrator. That's why it's completely just stricken here.
Okay. I understand that. I understand what you're saying. And please, other members of my team, feel free to jump in. I'm not trying to monopolize the conversation here. Okay.
Well, I think the stuff on arbitration is best handled by you.
Well, I don't know necessarily, but okay.
I miss.
No, but I think we'll have a discussion once you've gone through this, because, you know, again, as we're deleting parts, we're going to want to make sure that it's covered earlier on.
Yeah, I think it'll be very helpful to receive, you know, this document so that we can.
Yeah, we'll send that to you later today. Yeah.
That's right. Fantastic. So I'll send this copy to Talat since I did make a change, and then Talat
and
can send it
on. Yeah, I'll send it to all of you since Charlie's not around. So, yeah.
Are there any more questions?
No.
That we can.
Well, is this the last change?
Yeah, so our whole thing is that the grievance is a grievance, you know, I mean, the two sides to it, you know, the university should not have the right to just say unilaterally that, you know, we will not entertain this grievance because
I don't question that.
Okay.
My only concern is, and I think why we wanted some additional language, but as you said, this is a negotiation.
Yeah,
I don't mind that language, but what we want to avoid is, so if we have a dispute about whether it's timely or not, we take that to an arbitrator and the arbitrator says, yes, it's timely.
That's right.
But at that point, I don't want the arbitrator then move into the process, the hearing itself or whatever, because you know, again, if the arbitrator says, well, no, it's not timely filed, then that changes your approach to the arbitration. If he says it is, or she, new one, then we have to go back and say, okay, well, since we were wrong, since it is timely, who are we going to call as witnesses? What documents are we going to use? That's why we wanted to add a little bit of language there that says what you're only presenting that one issue when you present that issue to an arbitrator. You're not taking the whole package at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that's where we're coming from. And, you know,
maybe that has to be said more explicitly in that, you know, the sentence wasn't conveyed
that. But I'm not, we clearly.
So what you're saying is that if timeliness is an issue, then that issue be handled singly by itself.
Yeah, that gets handled right out of the gate.
Yeah, see, I get it. Yeah.
Once that's decided, then the party can go back and say,
okay,
let me know, what are we going to do about this?
Okay.
Isn't this section, the section about processing and essentially the first part of it, 2011A, already says, even if there's a grievance filed, the university can still continue doing what it seeks to do and what presumably the grievant is contesting, like, for example, non-reappointment or requiring certain kind of work or something like that. So this is we have to, as employees, continue to do things even while we're filing a grievance, right? So it's already providing that right to the university to continue to do that.
I think what Sherry is saying, if I understand it, is that if timeliness is the issue, we don't address it here because she's saying that should be addressed by itself. Not what everyone is grieving about, but whether it is timely or not. And we don't have a section that says that if timeliness is the issue, it should be handled separately.
I just don't know if that really is a separate issue. We have an agreement that about timelines. We have an agreement that are in terms of within 30 days and all the other kind of timely things that are spelled out in detail in previous sections. Mm-hmm. And we have them spelled out on the forms that we all agreed to and that we are agreeing are the forms we're going to use. So it's pretty clearly spelled out in excruciating detail how exactly, when, who signs what and turns it in. There can be lots of disagreements as a grievance goes along about is this actually relevant, is it timely, does this constitute this or that, but that's the matter of the grievance most of the time, right?
Well, yeah, I think maybe or maybe not. I don't mind keeping it in this section because I think we can't say that we're just going to throw this back at you and say, no, we're not going to process this because in our view, it's untimely. We truly can't do that, and I'm not advocating that we do. But what I'm saying is if that becomes an issue, it's a threshold issue. It is not, you'd want to not bifurcate the arbitrability here. But this is something I would clearly want to bifurcate. I don't want to have the timeliness decided and then immediately bring into a hearing on the merits of the case. So
yeah. So would you say that okay, I understand that what you're saying is timeliness from your perspective is the only aspect that needs to be clarified sort of before, if there's a disagreement about timeliness, before the grievance can proceed?
No.
We'll continue to process it, but we don't want to.
We separate the two issues, the issue of what the grievance is about and the issue of timeliness.
We'll keep on doing whatever it is we're going to do, but we're going to start on our side anyway. If we really believe that the grievance is untimely for one reason or another, I'm not going to start calling people and prepping them for witnessing. I'm not going to send out a request and say, I need all your emails and records about this particular issue until I know if I'm even going to have to do it or not.
Well, we're not talking about arbitration here now. This is about filing a grievance, right? And timeliness. So we're not really at stage three yet. We're about filing a grievance and then this is
filing a grievance or arbitrations.
Right.
It could be an arbitration.
It could be. But presumably issues of is it timely or not, what are the facts, would probably have been raised in a step one or in a step two hearing before already, right? So by the time that we get to this should now go to arbitration, that would be fairly spelled out. Is what you're saying that you would like some kind of a guarantee in here that you're not going to end up having to take through all three steps something that you believe is not timely? Is that what you're trying to get?
I don't think that's what she's saying, Claudia. It's possible that something will have to go through all three steps and have timeliness addressed. There could be a disagreement at step one about timeliness that's taken to step two. It could end up at arbitration. But what's challenging is if we are at arbitration where we're jointly paying to have a court reporter take notes, there are attorneys present on both sides being paid by the hour, and the first thing that the arbitrator is asked to do is to decide whether it's it's timely, the grievance is timely or not. And it may take some time for somebody to do that. And I don't know that an arbitrator can even make a decision on the spot about whatever the issues that need to be discussed in advance. Timeliness is just one example. It's not clear that a decision can be rendered right away. But in the event that a decision was made about, say, timeliness right away, and the arbitrator says, okay, let's go, call your first witness, well, the witnesses that might be selected could depend on whether or not the arbitrator says it's timely or not. And I think that's what Sherry's saying.
Yeah, no, I understand that that's the issue. If I'm not mistaken, this phrase that your side had suggested, if there's a question of timeliness, is a new addition, right?
Yeah. Well, all of
in the current contract that we currently or that we have been using, we don't have that. Right?
That's correct. That was an addition we proposed last time.
Right. But we didn't have the language that nothing shall authorize the university.
Sure, yeah.
Right.
Would it make sense to simply eliminate all of B?
Okay. I mean,
I think the article is long and detailed in terms of what exactly has to happen and when. Yeah. And this 2011 says, and even while the grievance is there, we still, university still gets to do something.
Well, from my perspective, this is a question of law, and it's settled law. So we don't have the ability to say we're going to start processing something because we think it's untimely. So I don't, we put a lot of stuff in that, we quote statutes and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But if we agree, and, I don't know how, you could certainly challenge us on that. If we said, no, we're just going to stop, but we would lose, and I know we would lose, so I'm not going to tell, and no attorney following me is going to say, do something that I know you can't do. So I'm comfortable either way.
So, just simply taking out everything under B, the current language, your proposed language, our proposed language, if you just eliminate B and simply leave the provision that there is, under A, would that be satisfactory?
Well, it would work for me.
I think it's an interesting suggestion. I'd kind of like to get another chance to read through the article.
I think why don't we leave it the way it is?
Yeah,
and then
it's a good, it's a very interesting possibility.
Can I, for note taking and stuff, can I make a comment on this document that we that both sides discussed removing this section?
Yes,
sure.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, because I think it's just an odd thing to have a document that spells out all kinds of rules and then says, but now there's going to be just leave it out. It's we have the rules spelled out. There's laws. We're just going to follow them, and that's that.
Yeah,
that works for me. But as I said,
Well, let's think about it. I just thought it might be one way to not go back and forth about the wording. Just remove the whole thing, and it might work better for what we already have there.
It was like the other one. It did not clarify. It confused more than clarify.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you've made some interesting changes, and our team will definitely have to spend some time looking at them and thinking about them.
Yeah.
And I think we're getting close on this article, which is
it's a difficult one. Anything else from anybody?
Oh, I'm going to go ahead and stop sharing now, and then I'll email this to you to lot to send.
Yeah, just send it to me right away. Yeah, thanks.
And of course, because I've got two very important members of my team who aren't here, we'll definitely have to have their input on these articles. So.
Sure. I think it's your turn next. If you have anything,
I don't. All I know is I sent a query and I got back, well, we're crunching numbers. But what that means or how soon, but all I know is that in August they have to present a proposed budget to the Board of Trustees. And I'll know before the budget goes to the Board of Trustees, but no, maybe not too far before that. So I don't know anything.
On 23.
Yeah.
On salary. So. And just to, you know, some of questions that have come up from the team and also from bargaining unit is that so these salary issues are going to be handled for all units at the same time, right, with the staff and, I mean, then are there different negotiations going on with the staff union as opposed to?
Well, of course, they do negotiate separately, AFSCME does, and so does the PBA. I don't know what the timing is on those. You know, they may be negotiating now, they may not be, but they're very different. This time, I think there's going to be the biggest divergence among the groups in terms of negotiations over salary, primarily because of that constitutional amendment. You know, requiring us to raise the salaries of our lowest paid employees. So that's a whole different issue than just getting a salary increase. So, you know, that'll be, the AFSCME bargaining should be interesting. I'm glad I'm not doing it.
So August is when they are going to be presenting something to the Board of Trustees.
Yep.
So, you know, in terms of, just as looking at the agenda, so Article 10 is something that you guys are working on. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We expect we'll have one next time on August 11th.
Next time around. Okay. And then Article 6 also, you mentioned that...
Sarah about that, and she is not necessarily opposed to that. We just haven't had time to put it together.
Okay.
Because I'm telling you, our office... just about our office and compliance and some other offices and student affairs have been drowning with the legislation that had to be implemented by July 1st. So,
I know. I was so glad that I had issued a letter before July 11th, 1st.
Yeah. I mean,
So I had, you know, before you came, Sherry, I had just mentioned about Ernie, who you may or may not know, one of the building managers and who's twice vaccinated and all that, and he came down with COVID. You know, this is not unheard of. So the one thing is this MOU, and I'll tell you why we think it is really important that we proceed on something. What we are afraid, because we're seeing more and more, you know, young people in particular, Florida is one of the places in particular where they're not vaccinated, they're getting COVID, and they are transmitting it to other people, particularly older people, and even vaccinated people are getting it. Now, the problem that we are seeing right now is that we are all saying, okay, they're going to be face-to-face classes, you've got 300 students in front of you, you've got this. The person gets COVID, I hope not, but if they do, we should have some things in place because COVID is a pandemic, it is not usual, and it is very transmittable. So what we were going to do with the MOU, we were not going to talk anything about tenure considerations and all of that. It has to be basically safety and what is to be done in case a faculty member has COVID. So for example, you know, having even provision, what I'm hopeful, and I may be totally off track here, is that if I'm hopeful that if vaccinated people do get COVID, it's going to be something mild, but they are contagious, so they cannot be coming. We don't want people to be in the position where they're saying, oh, I'm going to take my sick leave, I'm going to show up, and so what if somebody else gets COVID, you know? So we want to have some things in place where if individuals get COVID, they could opt to teach remotely. They've done it for a whole year. They could then convert their class into remote, or they could be other provisions. They could, for example, if they have to take leave, that leave need not be from their sick leave, because some people may not have sick leave. We have to think it through. The way we have to think it through is, what we don't want is for individuals to be taking a chance and coming to campus when they have COVID. We need to avoid that.
Well, I would agree with you there, but I think that those are decisions that are going to be made not on a unit-by-unit basis, but on a university basis. And right now, we don't have an emergency order in place, and we are being told that we are operating as normal. And I know that the university is developing plans and along the lines of what you're talking about, but I'm not inclined to do another round of impact bargaining on this at this point. I'm going to, you know, we'll see if the university doesn't come up with things that are, you know, come up with plans. But at the moment, I'm not inclined to start doing that again, because I just don't think that there's much that we can actually bargain on this, because we are so constrained by what the BOG and the legislature and the governor have told us. So we have very little ability to do anything, except to put some processes in place.
So has the legislature said that under no circumstances there be remote instruction? Have they said that?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. So the thing is that, I mean, one question to ask is, where does this conversation begin? And I know that this is being recorded, but I'm not going to run for office so I can say it. But, you know, we have people in the legislature who are pretty crazy and who are basically, you know, I mean, would go so far. I mean, they're in denial even to this day, right? So sanity has to sink in at some point. And, you know, if we were to, for example, require that everyone be vaccinated, I know that that's not a good thing to be saying, but, you know, there are universities that are requiring that. Indiana University is. Even the federal judge, a Republican federal judge, actually okayed that. So they are requiring it. Rutgers is requiring it. The number of universities requiring it. We are obviously not going to require that, at least not for the moment. But somewhere, some discussion has to go on, that we cannot be spreading this disease any more than we need to.
I'm not disagreeing with you, Talat, but I don't think that conversation happens between our bargaining teams right now. That's a higher level discussion that I don't think that we have the ability to make any real impact on.
So maybe we should find out what's happening on other campuses, because, you know, what we're obviously all following a certain Florida law or certain Florida climate, right? Yeah. So maybe we get some homework done and talk to other colleagues in other SUS and then see where they're going, because I know some places they are discussing it, others are not, and basically we go with that.
I certainly have no objection to seeing what other people are doing.
Yeah, and some assurance about what safety measures are going to be taken, or health measures are going to be taken. I mean, they cannot deny that people are not going to be catching COVID.
Oh no, I have a good friend who has been fully vaccinated. I'm just saying that even protective measures, we can't require people to be vaccinated, but even things like requiring social distancing in classes and masks, now we don't have the ability to do that. And that's, you know.
That's because they are mandating that not be done.
Yes.
So I think to interject that, I think we do, you know, in the previous MOUs, we do have the ability to influence you know, as certified bargaining agents of both our representative organizations, we do have the ability to talk about working conditions. And obviously, as both you and Talat said, rightly so, that the legislature has put some restrictions on what we can talk about. But, you know, I think we've demonstrated throughout the pandemic through the MOU structure that there are other measures such as accommodating working remotely for those who can't be in person, and for family members and so on and so forth. So the university is not interested in bargaining those conditions?
The university, I think at this point, is not interested in treating one group of employees significantly differently than other group of employees. They are trying to develop plans and processes that will apply to everyone at a university level. So, you know, I can bring this up, but that's my best understanding at the moment.
But also, you know, what we're talking about is really something that should affect everyone.
I absolutely agree. And that's why I think they are trying to put together things that will cover everyone.
So you think if we waited, I mean, we could wait another 3 weeks because, you know, we still don't have time before classes begin. What we're most afraid of is not having anything in place. And with the numbers that are rising of cases and classes starting exactly a month from now, and we have nothing in place, a faculty member or anybody, staff, anyone, they are affected with COVID, what happens?
Right.
It's not something of their own doing. It's because they're living in a state where there are no rules that protects them.
I am sympathetic. I mean, I truly am, because I'm not comfortable with the stance that our public officials have taken. I think it's short-sighted, especially with the Delta variant as contagious as it is. But nevertheless, I'm bound by it. So I will take this back to HR and USER and see what I can find out about what's being done on a university level.
Okay.
And try to report that back to you.
Yeah, and remember, you know, we can do things that you guys can't do. We have the more freedom to ask and to demand, and we're demanding it for everyone.
Well, you can demand a lot of things. Doesn't mean I can demand a lot of things too. I don't get most of them, but I can try.
Yeah. Anything else, folks, from anyone?
Not for me. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thank you. I think we had a productive day. I think we're close on two articles, which is always positive.
Yeah.
I know we've got a lot of work to do on 12, but, you know, sooner or later we get there.
And, right.
We will see you on the 11th.
On the 11th, yeah. And I'll send the articles that we did today and also a tentative agenda because Charlie and I talked a little bit about that. So we have some ideas. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great day.
Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.